This is Equal Rights and Justice, where we educate, agitate, and organize to empower we the people, for another world is possible, and we are the ones who must make it so. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. I'm speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, one of the great historians of our time. Gerald Horn is professor at the African American History at the University of Houston, a prolific scholar who has published more than 36 books. And now we discussed The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. Until the story of the hunt is told by the lion, the tale of the hunt will always glorify the hunter, an old African proverb. If I had to think of one word to define Dr. Gerald Horn, it would be very difficult, but I might think of the word iconoclast, because you have managed to tell the tale of the hunt so that it doesn't always glorify the hunter. Let's begin with that reality, the process itself. Why is it so important to talk about and rewrite the narrative of the myth of American exceptionalism, or to confront the myths of triumphalism enshrined in contemporary societies that valorize everybody from an Andrew Jackson to Edmund Pettus, i.e. the Ku Klux Klan, which is what the bridge that Congressman John Lewis's body was just carried over and still bears the name of Edmund Pettus, or even the Hamilton play with Lin-Manuel Miranda, which glorifies somebody like Hamilton and perpetuates a myth that this is somehow a Horatio Alger story rather than a man who was a slaver, among other things. So, Dr. Horn, why do you do what you do?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. Second of all, I would say that our understanding of history helps to govern and helps to shape what strategy and tactics we pursue today in 2020 in order to make a better world. For example, if we are of the persuasion that the founding of the United States of America in 1776 was a great leap forward for humanity, and if we take the position that the U.S. Constitution and its vaunted Bill of Rights formed a template for those who were initially excluded from its remit, speaking specifically of people of African descent and the indigenous population, that'll shape our strategy and tactics today. We will not necessarily reach out to the international community in order to seek assistance, because we recognize that there are disadvantageous circumstances facing us as we speak. It may tend to lead to an overestimation of the progressivism of the United States of America. It might lead us baffled as to why and how it is the 63 million people, mostly of European descent, voted for the present oath in the Oval Office. It may lead us to wrongheaded strategies with regard to ousting him from the Oval Office in November 2020. So history is very important in terms of shaping our present reality. For example, if you go to a doctor, one of the first things that a doctor does is take a detailed medical history. The doctor takes the detailed medical history because the doctor presupposes that whatever maladies and ills you're suffering at that particular moment may have something to do with the past, may have something to do with the conditions that were bequeathed to you. Unfortunately, today, many of our historians, or the equivalent of what I call antiquarian physicians, it's as if you go to a doctor and the doctor takes a detailed medical history, and then you wait for the diagnosis, and the doctor says, oh, no, I'm just into taking medical histories as a thing in themselves. I don't take them so I can make you feel better or make you be better. And that's one of the problems with how history is done today. It's done without any acknowledgement of the fact that what we're living today in many ways is just an extension of the past. And so in other words, in order to dig ourselves out of the deep hole in which we find ourselves, we have to have a detailed understanding of the past.
Dr. Horn, why have you threaded together in your book, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, the roots of slavery, white supremacy, settler colonialism, and capitalism? What is that intersectionality, the ties that bind literally and figuratively?
Well, first of all, if you don't ask proper and correct questions when you set out to write a history, oftentimes you will not emerge with proper and correct answers. In this book on the 16th century, I was trying to understand and comprehend a very simple point. How and why is it that I and many other people of African descent in particular are in North America speaking a language, English, when we know that when Columbus crossed the Atlantic in 1492, he was sponsored by the Spanish. England was a minor monarchy on the fringes of Europe. So how and why was it that England was able to surge ahead, and by 1607, the terminal point of the long 16th century, beginning in 1492 with Columbus, England in 1607 was able to establish this settlement in what they called Virginia on the eastern seaboard of North America. And part of the answer rests in religion. There was the so-called Protestant Reformation led by Martin Luther, which swept through England in the 1530s. At the same time, this leads to religious conflict between the Spanish powers led by Spain, which had first movers advantage in the Americas, as evidenced by their sponsoring of Columbus and evidenced by the fact that a significant percentage of people in this hemisphere still speak Spanish language. What happens is that the Spanish have a religious qualification for being a settler. That is to say, you could be an African and you could be a conquistador as long as you profess Catholicism. The English, not necessarily in my telling by blueprint, but by improvisation, when they begin to challenge Spain, there are not enough Protestants to go around at that time to use that as a qualification for settlement. And so improvisationally, they move to pan-Europeanism, which then morphs into whiteness and then ultimately morphs into white supremacy. This is taking place in the context of religious conflict. For example, a turning point in my telling of the story comes when the Ottoman Turks, who are the other major power in Europe, if not the world, at that particular moment, and of course are Muslim, in some sense underestimate London and strike up an alliance with London against their mutual foe in Spain. This turns out to backfire, because, of course, London uses that alliance in some ways to make great and gigantic strides for itself. In fact, as I tell the story to rope the question of enslavement of Africans into this narrative, a turning point in terms of the precipitous decline of Africa comes in 1591 when London, in league with the Muslim power that was Morocco, wages war against the Songhai Empire in the area now, I guess you could say, that encompasses Mali. This leads to the destabilization of this powerful African state, which has negative knock-on effects ricocheting and cascading as far south as today's Nigeria, softening up West Africa for the onrushing African slave trade, which then begins to accelerate post-1591, and this takes place at a time when the Ottomans, too, are involved in enslaving Africans, but they're enslaving Europeans, too. They're an equal opportunity enslaver. As the history of Albania and Bosnia and Kosovo and Bulgaria tends to suggest, the Spanish are enslaving the indigenous population of the Americas, but they're also enslaving the land they call the Philippines, which is named after their monarch, King Philip, and there are thousands of Filipinos dragged across the Atlantic to Mexico up until the end of the 17th century. The English, who not only focused like a laser beam on enslaving Africans, but also are a pioneer in the noxious ideology of white supremacy, and also as a result of those forces get a leg up in terms of constructing the system we now refer to as capitalism, which also in many ways is a result of this other system in which we're now ensnared, although even some of our friends on the left don't use this phrase, sadly and tragically enough. I'm speaking of settler colonialism, the process whereby settlers from the British Isles are transported across the Atlantic to oust the indigenous population and set themselves up as a ruling elite. And once again, what happens is that London, because they're under the gun, they're the scrappy underdog in terms of their conflict with Spain, they cannot be choosy in terms of settlers. And so therefore, Irish Catholics, who London had been warring with, ostensibly on a religious basis, Protestant London versus Irish Catholics, they are allowed to be settlers in America, in North America. As well, London expels the Jewish population in 1291, almost 200 years before Spain does, as the Inquisition accelerates in 1492. But London, because it's a scrappy underdog and can't be choosy in terms of settlers, also opens its embrace to have Jewish settlers as well. This, of course, in some ways is encapsulated in the vaunted First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which guarantees, quote, religious liberty, unquote. But as I tell the story, the First Amendment should not be seen necessarily as a process of enlightenment. That is to say, in the eyes of certain men, they come to this dawning realization that religious liberty should be the order of the day. That's an idealistic phrasing, and I mean that in a negative sense. That is to say, it's basically saying that your being is determined by your consciousness as opposed to the other way around. As I tell the story, this First Amendment is the kind of aspect. It's constituting a certain kind of whiteness. It's constituting a certain kind of settler colonialism, because London and the settlers that follow London, led by George Washington, realize that they need every warm European body, every body defined as white, that they can round up. And therefore, religious sectarianism, which was Spain's specialty, using Catholicism as a qualification for settlement, just would not do.
So you talk about settler colonialism and the dispossession of the land of the indigenous population. And then we get to the development of the system of plantation capitalism, which is rooted itself in a color hierarchy, white supremacy. And how do we morph from general kind of settler colonialism, the dispossession of the indigenous people, and then towards an economic system of plantation capitalism, which it defines as its ideological root and as its systemic imperative, and out of which I think policing grows, and that is the concept of white supremacy and the color hierarchy that is prevalent within today's society as well.
First of all, you need to recognize that the slave trade is one of the most profitable enterprises known to humankind. You can invest $1 and get $1,700 back. In order to transport both settlers and enslaved Africans across the Atlantic, you need ships, which then helps to develop a construction of shipping industry, which then leads to a working class with wages. And then in what London considers to be a virtuous circle, they have wages that can then be used to buy other products. In order to have a slave trade, you also need an insurance industry, because what happens is that oftentimes, the Africans would rebel, and therefore the investors would lose their investment. But if there's an insurance industry and they pay premiums, they can get compensated. And as Warren Buffett and other billionaires can tell you, the insurance industry throws off a lot of excess capital because oftentimes the insurance industry finds a way not to pay when there is a pandemic, for example. And then that excess capital then can help to fund a banking industry that can provide seed capital for other industries. And so it goes. And so you see that the slave trade and slavery provides the primitive accumulation of capitalism. Now, with regard to this hierarchy, once again, this is something that one can trace back to its religious roots. As I tell the story in the 16th century book that's the subject of our conversation, in many ways, racism grows out of religion. I've been embarked on this long-term process of trying to track down the roots of white supremacy. In my 17th century book, I thought I had found the roots in the 17th century. In this book in the 16th century, I tried to trace its roots to the 16th century, but actually I go back even to 1095 and the origins of the so-called Crusades, where the Western European Christian powers feel the need to reclaim what they call the Holy Land and wage war against Muslims, and that leads to a certain kind of racialization of the Muslims. It leads to a certain kind of othering process, and I suspect that from those roots you begin to see this process of racialization that eventually snares the enslaved African population. And as many people have pointed out, slavery is a process that did not only include people of African descent, but what helps to distinguish slavery in North America is this racialization process whereby those who are victimized by slavery are seen as a racialized others, defined as inferior, defined in fact as either non-human or, as the U.S. Constitution would have it, as three-fifths of a human being. This is a kind of enslavement by epidermis, which becomes the specialty of London, which is then taken to the nth degree by its revolting spawn, which revolts and secedes from the British Empire in 1776. Now, speaking of this land known as the United States of America, and I'm sure your listeners know the story about how, for example, the urban police departments that have been so notorious of late in terms of engaging in on-camera lynching, such as happened in Minneapolis with George Floyd on May 25th, 2020, in some ways have their roots in terms of the slave patrols, which were designed to make sure that runaway Africans were dragged back to the plantation or their work site in order to continue to work for free, producing major fortunes for Euro-Americans through which they could build a modern society.
And, of course, the slave codes, the Jim Crow laws, also have their roots in the imperative to maintain a racial hierarchy as a system of control both of the individualized labor and still the maintenance of that labor force for what was still the dominant economic development mechanism, and that was plantation capitalism, which then begins to, you know, industrialism takes on, gives it a somewhat different, and yet today we still find the imperative of maintaining that ideological and institutional hierarchy and that disparity of treatment that more and more people are referring to as white supremacy. So I just want to take you through, for the moment, today, as we look at Black Lives Matter, and the movement that influenced me in a similar way was the Black Liberation Movement. Now it's the Black Lives Matter movement, and it's part of a continuum, part of an imperative for people to strike out and take on that liberatory character. But the imperative today, and what you see, if you will, as the difference between racism, which seems to be a kind of attitudinal component, and the reality of white supremacy and its correlation with and the needs that capitalism has for it, as it evolved out of all the things that you talk about in The Dawning of the Apocalypse, the roots of slavery, white supremacy, settler colonialism, and capitalism in the long 16th century.
It's interesting, as we talk about white supremacy today and where it goes from here, one way to look at what's happened to the United States over the past 70 years is that because of international conditions, not least the rise of a socialist camp, which then began to make appeals to rising liberation movements in Africa and the Caribbean, Washington found itself at a disadvantage in competing for hearts and minds in these resource-rich areas, as long as people of African descent in this country were treated so atrociously. So this creates momentum for Brown versus Board of Education, the agonized retreat from the more egregious aspects of Jim Crow. The problem is, unlike what many of our liberal friends and historians have told us, is that this was not a decision that was greeted with unanimity across class lines in the Euro-American community. Witness the riots in Little Rock, Arkansas, in the face of school desegregation in 1957, riots in Oxford, Mississippi, in the face of the desegregation of University of Mississippi in 1962, to show it wasn't sectional, the riots in Boston as a result of school desegregation in the 1970s, in Yonkers, the unrest and uprisings that greeted housing desegregation. And so in some ways, you can see the November 2016 election as one last, hopefully last, lurch by those disgruntled with desegregation, those disgruntled by what could be termed a devaluation of the currency that is whiteness and white supremacy when black people and other people of color were allowed into the hallowed halls of universities from which they were theretofore excluded and therefore were able to attain a certain kind of status and then begin to provide stiff competition for positions in the middle strata, for example, that November 2016 represented a kind of revolt and rebellion against that entire 70-year process. In other words, it wasn't just Fox News going on the airwaves in the 1990s, because, of course, as I just said, there were revolts and right-wing populist stratagems before the 1990s. And so, therefore, in November 2020, in many ways, we're going to determine what the future course of this nation will be. And, of course, this is taking place in a global context where you have China, which, as you know, was involved with U.S. imperialism since the early 1970s, now seemingly is in the passing lane. And so you have the Republican Party, led by Donald Trump, basically trying to run the trifecta. They're running against Black Lives Matter in the streets of from New York to Portland. They're running against people of Latinx origin amongst the border, who are being repressed by the Border Patrol and ICE. The third aspect of this triptych of people of color is the People's Republic of China, which, if you follow the recent speeches by Michael Pompeo, Secretary of State, or FBI Director Christopher Wray, or Attorney General William Barr, you will know that we're now in the midst of a new Cold War with consequences too ghoulish to contemplate. So this election of November 2020 in some ways will not only determine what happens with regard to the settler state, which had its roots in the 16th century, in some ways it'll determine the future of white supremacy, and in some ways it'll determine the future of capitalism as well.
One of the things that I was particularly fascinated by about, and that was the events that happened in Florida, some of the intersection that you have begun to build into this book, and that was the relationship between the indigenous peoples of Florida, the indigenous people of this land, and the enslaved Africans who were brought here and turned in to, by virtue of their free labor, the cornerstone of the development of plantation capitalism, of capitalism, et cetera. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit more about what you think some of your additional thoughts are on that kind of intersectionality between the indigenous populations and the development of the not just slavery as an economic system, but again as white supremacy and the hierarchy and the imperative, which became so important, indeed, perhaps the foundation of the development, both politically and economically, of the U.S. culturally, economically, and indeed politically.
Once again, I think many historians have made a fundamental error or chronology when they place the origins of settler colonialism in either Virginia in 1607 or what is called Massachusetts a few years later, when we all know that the Spanish had established a settlement in St. Augustine, Florida, which built itself as the longest continuous urban node in North America, established in 1565. From the beginning, there were enslaved Africans in Florida, in St. Augustine, and originally Florida in some ways was an adjunct of Cuba. The settlement was put in Florida in the first instance in order to provide a kind of base through which English pirates like Sir Francis Drake and French pirates as well could be attacked from Florida in order to protect Cuba. What's interesting is that from the inception, you had enslaved Africans escaping to the Native American side, joining alongside Native Americans to fight the Spanish conquistadors. And indeed, even before the establishment of St. Augustine, Florida in 1565, the Spanish from their perch in Santo Domingo, in what is now the Dominican Republic, had brought enslaved Africans to what is now South Carolina to establish a settlement there. But the enslaved Africans escaped to the Native American side and kicked the Spanish out, who then fled back to the Caribbean. So in some ways, the story that I'm telling is that even though Spain had the first mover's advantage with regard to settlements in the Americas, after all, they sponsored Christopher Columbus, what happens is that the Africans and the indigenous population, oftentimes jointly, oftentimes separately, put up such fierce resistance to Spanish settler colonialism that they engage in a process of mutual exhaustion, which then allows the English to glide into what they call Virginia in 1607, even though the Spanish in St. Augustine and in Cuba realize what's happening, they cannot move to repel the English from what they call Virginia because they're tied down fighting the Native Americans and fighting the Africans. I should also say that Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, who is billed as a possible successor as a Republican president by 2024, has just introduced a bill to Congress which would seek to stop federal funding to any kindergarten through 12th grade school that uses the New York Times 1619 project as part of their educational curriculum. In the context of making this legislative maneuver, he referred to slavery as a so-called necessary evil with regard to the formation of the United States of America. And I've oftentimes said, and this is a statement not only directed to Senator Cotton, but some of our friends on the left, that if you can rationalize mass enslavement of Africans, just like you can rationalize dispossession and genocide of Native Americans, you can rationalize just about anything, and that sets the stage for future evil. What's also striking is that some establishment historians have been critical of the 1619 Project, even though in order to craft that project, as the architects of the 1619 Project of the New York Times magazine pointed out, they have to rely upon historians who have been misleading, as I've already said, by putting the arrival of enslaved Africans in 1619 when actually, if anything, it's in the 1520s in what is now called South Carolina. Florida, it seems to me, is part of the key to understanding the subsequent evolution, or some might say devolution, of settler colonialism that eventuates in the United States of America. Because keep in mind that as of 1776, because of military maneuvers, London had basically taken over Florida by the time George Washington and Thomas Jefferson lead their secession campaigns in the British Empire. But Florida was the dog that didn't bark. It was the colony, the settlement that did not succeed. I suspect it's because of the heritage of Spanish settler colonialism, which, as noted, opened the door on the basis of Catholicism to have black conquistadors, and black conquistadors had been collaborating with enslaved Africans across the border in the English settlements, witness Stonewall's Revolt in South Carolina in 1739, the bloodiest revolt in North America during the colonial period, which was basically assisted into being in no small measure by Spanish black soldiers in uniform. And so they wanted no part of this secession movement. And then when finally Spain regains Florida, and then the United States moves to oust Spain from Florida 200 years ago, 1819 to 1820, there's a steady flotilla of ships with black people fleeing Florida at the oncoming arrival of U.S. rule heading for Cuba. Despite that, you still had bloody war between this black Native American alliance, particularly black people aligning with the people we call the Seminoles. Three bloody wars, 1819, 1820, 1830s, and the 1850s, some of the bloodiest wars the United States was involved in before Vietnam, before finally the settler class in North America prevails, and they force a massive ethnic cleansing of these Native Americans and black people who wind up on the border between Texas and Mexico, where their descendants continue to reside.
You're listening to Equal Rights and Justice. I'm Mimi Rosenberg, speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, one of the great historians of our time, on the dawning of the apocalypse, the roots of slavery, white supremacy, settler colonialism, and capitalism in the long 16th century. Dr. Horn, one of the things that may seem to be a bit of a departure, but I am so interested in your thoughts on this, given your history, and I said that part of your history is not only that you've written at least three dozen books, but you've been involved in the seminal issues and days of the affirmative action movement when it was contested by Bakke and so on, and the founding of the National Conference of Black Lawyers and many things like that. And one of the concerns that I have now is, as well-intentioned or as liberal organizations become somewhat more introspective, they also seem to hide behind the fact of the service function that they provide for communities, and therefore their behavior could not possibly be racist. And race is looked at as essentially a feature of attitudes, of collegiality, or the lack of, or as some people would say, rendering somebody invisible rather than seeing them. And yet there's very, very, very little discourse that I can see in many institutions, including ones that I work with, that have to deal with the issue of a white supremacy as a power structure and what it means to break that down in terms of the economic component, the wages, the benefits, the power relationship, the managerial classes, the accumulation of wealth. And so we certainly in the past have seen during similar periods, again during in the aftermath of the Black Liberation Movement, there was much capitulationism, there was certainly opportunism. How now do we look at these issues and utilize this tremendous pointed educational moment not to tool around the edges, but really get to the heart in liberal organizations, in liberal communities, of what really racism is about and how to break it and break its back structurally, or as they would say in the law, you know, pull it out, root and branch?
Well, that's the $64 question, is it not? But
it's probably worth more these days, but yeah.
$64 billion question. $64 trillion question. In any case, let me first advert to history before I fast forward to the present. This structure of white supremacy, I would argue, is built into the settler colonialism constructed by London. And as I say in the book that's the subject of our conversation, in some ways, the precursor of London, in some ways, London's stalking horse was the Netherlands. As you know, the land on which you're sitting was controlled by the Dutch up until 1664 when they're swept out of power by London. In some ways, these two Protestant powers are pioneers in constructing what is euphemistically called modernity, which is a kind of code word for the plunder of Africa and the Americas, and then subsequently Asia in particular, with the plundering conducted on a racialized basis, which means that white supremacy is baked into the cake. It's part of the essential alpha and omega of this euphemism we call modernity. It's no accident that the highest stage of white supremacy, in some ways, is reached with the construction of apartheid in South Africa in 1948. Recall that it was the Dutch who sailed to the southern tip of Africa in 1652 and established a settlement around the area we now refer to as Cape Town, and that it was the Dutch, in some ways, who provided many of the models that the English emulated. In both my 17th and 16th century books, I used the metaphor that by supporting the Dutch in their ongoing conflict with the Spanish, particularly beginning in the 16th century, in some ways, the English were saying that they would fight the Spanish to the last Dutchman. In some ways, the English were basically fattening the Dutch sheep for slaughter by London itself, which of course takes place in Manhattan in 1664. Now, to fast forward to the question that you posed, as I've tried to suggest in these books and in our brief conversation, white supremacy is not just a matter of attitudes, it's a matter of structure and power. It's baked into the cake, and then it becomes self-perpetuating when finally, because of our international alliances, we're able to force a U.S. Civil War that concludes with the abolition of slavery in 1865. There is no reparations delivered to the enslaved population, and therefore that leaves them the position, because of the Jim Crow regime that follows slavery, to pass down poverty from one generation to the next generation. And as the scholar Richard Rothstein and many others have talked about in the post-World War II dispensation, you have federal government housing policies, which fundamentally help to construct so-called white suburbs, and at the same time delimit the possibility of black people getting into the housing market to build that kind of nest egg, which oftentimes is the seed of a family accumulating wealth. Now, fortunately, we are at a moment post May 25th, 2020, with the George Floyd lynching on camera, where there has been a massive uprising against white supremacy, but I hope I'm not throwing cold water on the raging fires by suggesting it's too soon to tell how this will eventuate. That is to say, it may be overly premature, if not naive, to suggest that 8 weeks of protest can erode hundreds of years of white supremacy and bias that's structured into a society. But certainly, it's a marvelous start in that direction, and we all know that a trip of 1,000 miles begins with one step. And in any case, a very telling signal took place just a few weeks ago at the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, when, spurred by Burkina Faso in West Africa, the African Union, the Pan-African Transcontinental Body headquartered in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, filed a motion at the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva calling for a commission of inquiry into what they term, quote, systemic racism, unquote, in the United States of America. So this was a profound step forward. Unfortunately, because of vigorous arm twisting and lobbying by Washington. It did not take flight, but I doubt if this is the end of the story. I dare say that this is just one of many efforts to try to internationalize the question of white supremacy in the United States, because we know that historically the way white supremacy has been forced to retreat has been precisely because of international pressure. Recall my point a few moments ago about the rise in national liberation movements and the socialist camp, how that leads to Brown versus Board of Education. In that context, Paul Robeson, the great actor and activist, in 1950-51 helps to engineer the We Charge Genocide petition precisely at the United Nations, which puts Washington on notice that it was to be placed in the dock to answer for its many crimes against humanity, not least against black people, which have no statute of limitations. They can be prosecuted at the end of the 21st century or the beginning of the 22nd. And likewise, with regard to the agonized retreat from slavery, that took place not least because of pressure put on Washington by an international coalition led by revolutionary Haiti, assisted by British abolitionists in particular, which helped to force and compel a civil war that led to the abolition of slavery. So that's just an elongated way of saying that this African Union petition in June 2020 was a very significant and profound step towards uprooting, root and branch, to use your phrase, this ugly, pestiferous system of white supremacy that has spelled misery for millions for so many centuries.
And one of the things, there's so many different parts of that have really evolved and I think enlarged the consciousness of untold numbers of people, some begrudgingly, others willingly beginning to get more in touch with their own limitations, the concept of white supremacy, the concept of white privilege. One of the things that I was particularly taken by is Ashland, North Carolina, where there is a conceptualization of reparations that has been granted by the council, which is not like what the people in Tulsa are still fighting for, who are the descendants of the massacred people of 1921, who are still in Tulsa seeking reparations for their descendants' loss of property and death in what was known as Black Wall Street. But here the concept was to really fortify the wealth of the overall community and pump money into Black institutions, if you will, that can generate a wealth and create something perhaps akin to what Black Wall Street was in Tulsa. And I'm interested in your thoughts about the importance of reparations as a demand and the particular type of reparations that, at least in Asheville, the city council there seems to have approved.
Well, first of all, reparations, that is the order of the day, and I'd like to point you to the new book published by my former Chapel Hill colleague, William Darity, From Here to Equality, which is probably the most detailed exploration of this concept, and I think is providing jet propulsion and momentum to this needed struggle. I should also say that Asheville has been emulated, if not anticipated, by Evanston, Illinois, just outside of Chicago, which has tried to provide a similar kind of municipal reparations, I think providing in some ways a blueprint and a model for a larger metropolis, that is to say New York City. But my colleague Darity also feels that these municipal efforts should not be seen as a way to diverge from the pressure on the U.S. federal government to step up to the plate. And step number one, of course, is passing the bill introduced for years by the late Congressman John Conyers of Detroit, H.R. 40, which I think is, at least I hope, is on the verge of passing, which calls for a commission to study the question of reparations. Now, you mentioned the question of Tulsa, and pardon me for once again reverting to history, because one of the reasons you can have a Black Wall Street is because of a long history preceding the massacre of 1921. What I mean is that the people we refer to as the Cherokees, they tried to assimilate up to including owning enslaved Africans, but still Mr. Trump's favorite president, Andrew Jackson, forced them on the Trail of Tears, along with other Native American groupings, including the Choctaw, including the people we call the Creek and others. They're told to, they could live in Oklahoma, Indian Territory. And of course, you saw the recent decision opinion penned by Justice Gorsuch that fundamentally says that the eastern half of Oklahoma, which includes Tulsa, the treaties were not upheld. And so there's going to have to be some tremendous back and forth to determine if that should be, once again, Indian Territory. But in any case, the point that I'm making is that many of the Cherokees, they side with Confederacy during the U.S. Civil War. And interestingly enough, the Cherokee slave owners are perhaps the only slave owners who are forced to disgorge the equivalent of 40 acres and a mule to their formerly enslaved property. And this helps to explain why these black people in Tulsa had so much property and controlled so much property, because they were not left bereft the way, say, people in Mississippi and South Carolina were. But alas, what happened is that in 1921, the Euro-American settlers decided that enough of that, and so they used a flimsy pretext to plunder and pillage the black community of Tulsa and take their wealth, which now means that the black community of Tulsa is now embarked on its own reparations quest, which hopefully will end in success.
Well, we've just about come full circle, and we have given the lion the opportunity to disgorge to us the story of the hunt and completely cast a new narrative. And so finally within that, I have not left the horrible vision in my mind of seeing Trump standing under the Mount Rushmore with in the distance, generally ignored by the media, sister and brother, indigenous people in protest. And again, the importance and the strategicness of exactly what is happening, the dismantling of and expanding it to the removing of the name Margaret Sanger, who was a eugenicist, the removal of Columbus, a murderous colonialist, re-looking at the symbol of the city of New York, which has a man, no matter how they want to cast it, a colonialist standing there with a rope that is fashioned as a noose and a partially naked Indian, et cetera, and in front of the Museum of Natural History, finally getting rid of that monstrous sculpture of Teddy Roosevelt with the naked indigenous person and the naked slave on the other side of them, subservient. And the importance of all that, the importance of reconstructing and recasting the narrative, and the fact that certainly Black Lives Matter is forcing these changes, whether they lead to the continuation of the dismantling of the system of white supremacy. Yes, the story is not told, but that too may become our history in another year and a successful one. So your final thoughts on being the iconoclast that you are and others trying to destroy these icons of white supremacy, and damn it, have to change the name of the Edmund Pettus Bridge forthwith, as well as the Voting Rights Act being named after John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis.
There's a certain kind of amnesia, I'm afraid to say, that afflicts too many of our compatriots here in North America. Perhaps they did not recall that as 1776 was gathering steam, the statue of King George was torn down
not only torn down, but if a statue can be mutilated, it could be said that that statue was mutilated. That was an expression of the arrival of what they considered to be a new order. Not only that, but the university we now refer to as Columbia, I take it in homage to the Genocidaire of 1492, it was formerly King's College. That is to say, a not so oblique reference to King George himself. And so once again, the name was changed in order to signify the arrival of a new order. Now, all of a sudden, when you're talking about tearing down statues and monuments and engaged in renaming, that's shown as an erasure of history, although the so-called U.S. patriots, if I can use that term advisedly, do not have a similar critique about what was occurring in the 1770s, perhaps because they're ignorant of it. But we also know that it would be an outrage to see that statues of those who honor the so-called Third Reich in Berlin were left standing after May 1945. We also know that in South Africa, there has been the whole Rhodes Must Fall movement to take down statues of the plunderer and swashbuckling murderer Cecil Rhodes, who somehow gave his name to African countries, speaking of Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, or Southern Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, Northern Rhodesia, now Zambia. And we also know that this Black Lives Matter movement has taken fire overseas, leading to the takedown of statues in Bristol, to the slave trader Colston. And we also see that it led directly to an apology by the monarchy in Brussels to the people of the Congo. We know of the depredations committed by King Leopold there in the late 19th century, personally responsible, he and his minions, for the deaths of about 10 million people, not to mention the disfiguring of faces, the chopping off of noses and lips, the cutting off of limbs and hands for people who did not want to engage in a forced labor regime. So the built environment is very important. It is an important environment. It's an insult to, as the victim of settler colonialism and slavery, to walk, as they have been doing in Richmond, Virginia until recently, down Monument Avenue, where you have these towering statues honoring slave owners and people who tried to overthrow the U.S. government in order to perpetuate enslavement of Africans forevermore, such as Robert E. Lee. This is an insult, and I'm happy to see that there is now contemplation of changing the name of Fort Bragg and other sorts of military encampments in North America named after these traitors and slave owners. And I take my hat off to this Black Lives Matter movement for what they've been able to accomplish in such a short period of time. But alas, there are many more miles to walk, many more miles to walk before we reach the point of freedom.
Well, you know, one of the quotes on the back of your enormously important book, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century, says another stunning masterwork from the preeminent radical historian of our era. And indeed, you are, and it is a gem. And I thought to myself during periods of being kind of cloistered, other than running from demonstration to demonstration, which I do with great zest and joy, notwithstanding some of the concerns about contagion these days. But this is an opportunity to also to read, to think, to study, to move us forward and to put things within the historic context always. And Dr. Horn does that. So I am really strongly recommending Get the Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. It says it all. And then you can follow that through with perhaps another reading, or if you haven't read it before, Black Reconstruction in America by W.E.B. Du Bois, two of the really critical reads of this time to get us to that stage of pulling out root and branch white supremacy as a system from this country. Dr. Gerald Horn, it has been, as always, instructional and an absolute pleasure to listen to you.
Thank you for inviting me.
I've been speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, one of the greatest historians of our time, indeed, our national treasure, and looking at The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. You've been listening to Equal Rights and Justice. Stay safe, stay well, stay strong. And don't forget to listen to Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mondays, 7 p.m. over WBAI Radio.